3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
Because the land to us is the whole thing, right? The land is an ecosystem. It's not real estate.
Blockading is symbolic, but it's also literal, because what you're saying is whatever's being done, it stops here. And it's deadly here because you're laying your body on the line.
Welcome to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a summer series on Community Radio 3CR which looks at the history of environmental blockading in Australia, Canada and the US. I'm Ian McIntyre and today's program features a conversation with Canadian activist Marlena Smith about the campaign against mineral exploration in Strathcona Park from 1986 onwards. Located near the centre of British Columbia's Vancouver Island, Strathcona Park was the first area in the province to be set aside for recreational use and ecological protection in 1911. Nevertheless, resource extraction continued in this and other parks, and it was only in 1973 that new mining projects were banned in them. Those holding mineral exploration licences subsequently sued the provincial government on the basis of potentially lost profits. Citing the need to avoid major payouts, the British Columbian government opted to change the boundaries of six parks, rezoning 110,000 hectares as recreation areas subject to mining, hunting and logging, and removing 50,000 hectares altogether. The applicability of the original court ruling to all of these areas was placed under question by subsequent legal research and findings. Public anger regarding what was seen as a push to erode environmental protection came to focus on Strathcona Park. Rezoning meant that mining would extend from an existing site into 10,000 hectares of the 190,000 hectare park centre. The threat of mining also generated concerns about the effects on fisheries and the quality of nearby residents' water supplies. A campaign to prevent exploration by the Cream Silver Mining Company and reverse the deletion of sections from the existing park was begun in 1986. Eventually culminating in a blockade during 1988. My conversation with Marlena Smith begins with her outlining the history of the park and the formation of the Friends of Strathcona Park.
Strathcona Park is quite unique. It is a provincial park, and it was the first park to be established in British Columbia, and it was in 1911. And at that time when it was established, there were no mining and logging and resource extraction was all denied. So it was a total protection for the environment as it was. And then at the same time when Strathcona Park was formed, they created what was called the Park Act. And on the heels of that, other areas of the province were protected and added to that park system. So the interesting part is that whenever something is going to be changed on the park system, they always try it out first as Strathcona Park. So in 1918, they changed the Park Act to allow mining and to allow staking of claims. However, the curious thing is they were allowed to stake claims, mining claims, but they were not allowed to own the surface of the land. And you have three different types of mining claims. I don't know if you have that in Australia. One is Crown granted, which means that you outright own the claim and you don't need to maintain it. It's like the government grants you a house. The second one is the free miners claim, which means that you have to pay the government money every year, and every so many time you have to prove that you have worked the claim. If you don't work it and you don't pay the money, the government takes it back, which is an important issue because that means if the government wants those claims back, they don't need to compensate that mining company or the shareholders of that mining company for all the unknown values of the unknown amount of minerals in the ground. And the third one is placer mining claims, where they just go to the river and they just, you know, sift the gravel through little sifts and sluice gates to find gold. So the ones that happened in Strathcona Park is Crown-granted claims and free miner claims. So both of them were staked in the period between 1918 and when the government put a moratorium back on the mining. So in the meantime, the government did other things with Strathcona Park. So this is before our blockade happened. Logging in the park, they traded parts, valleys and mount areas and hillsides that they thought were did not have high recreational values. They allowed the timber to be taken out and then exchanged that to buy another piece of parkland. So leading up to this blockade, various environmental concerned people, one of them in particular, Roderick Hake Brown, who was a judge and old fisherman of Campbell River, which is downstream from Butler Lake, has fought the fight to protect the park and the old growth timber and the fish for years, but he lost it. The other person that was very important was a fellow by the name of Jim Boulding. Jim Boulding and his wife started a lodge at Butler Lake for the purpose of educating school children in the protection of the environment and educating about outdoor activities and outdoor wilderness. When in 1986, the government decided to look at the park system, it was at that time in sole government, and under pressure of the corporations, they decided to take a look at the protected areas and the park system and delete those areas that had mining potentials or logging potentials or damming potentials or whatever other potentials to make money. Now, the reason that the government wanted to open the park up and delete parts of the park and open it up for mining was because of a case, a court case by a mining company called the Tanner case in Wells Gray Park. And Cream Silver, interestingly enough, had started a lawsuit, you could say, against the government because there was a moratorium on exploring in the park. So they started a lawsuit against the government that would inhibit them exploring their claims, and they wanted to have the claims, and so they wanted to sue the government for untold value of compensation for not being able to work their claims. So on the basis of that, that is why the government opened the park up for mining. A lot of people had tried to stop the government. A lot of people had gone out in the park and protected the park, tried to protect the park, but nobody had actually done anything. So that led up to the formation of the Friends of Strathcona Park. Jim Boulding, the same Jim Boulding, and Steve, my partner, and myself worked at the lodge. We both came from Europe. We were both avid mountaineers, and we were both had hiked and climbed and did mountaineering in the European Alps. But we had never seen complete untouched wilderness like you have here, and I'm sure you have still in Australia, in our lives before. So we totally got it, what it means to leave wilderness areas alone and not touch it, and what the value of that was, not just for people, but for itself, and for the wildlife, and just for the natural things, because one day, maybe we have to go there and relearn again. So in 1986, Jim Boulding alerted us. He went to a meeting organized by the government where they proposed to delete large sections of various parks, provincial parks, and protected areas to allow mining and logging. And then Strathcona Park was hit the hardest. So he gave us the information, and then a year later, in early 1987, he was on his deathbed of pancreatic cancer, and he asked me personally if I could take over his fight. We decided the park needed friends, and so that is when the Friends of Strathcona Park were created. What is important for me, if I promise somebody, certainly somebody on their deathbed, to do something, I will do it. So what we did, we visited every part of the park that was slated to be deleted for mining or logging or hydro generation. We connected with local people that lived in that area or nearby, what that part of the park meant and what was special about it. We then realized that especially one part, which is the center part of the park, which is at the headwaters of Butter Lake, an area called Cream Lake, is, I would say, very special. It is the heart of the park. when we connected with the First Nations, that are the Aboriginal people here, they said that was a special part of the park, that is where the shamans would go, and that was a spiritual spot because the water flows in three different directions, to the south, to the west, and to the east. And so that was a power spot for them. So we then started to connect with the government and had objections to the deletions. We learned about their reasons to delete the park, or that part of the park to allow mining, were flawed, because it was based on not financially, fiscally, not being able to compensate the mining companies for the untold value of their ore. And we proved that it was flawed. And I go back to the fact that most of those mining claims that they wanted to allow to be explored were free miner claims. So they did not own the land of the surface of the land. So they could, based on the Park Act, they could deny them access and they could take those claims back. But the government decided not to do.
Other than the threat to the park itself, what motivated people to get involved in the campaign?
The ore is deposited in the form of sulfate, copper sulfate, and iron sulfate, etc. And when you mine that, when that is exposed to the air and to the water, you get sulfuric acid. And the sulfuric acid will acidify the water, and then copper in particularly, but many other metals as well, will go in solution. And there was a mine, an old mine site, which they mined for a very short period of time, and they abandoned it, right where I live, that happened there, and the sulfuric acid and the copper, the dissolved copper, killed the whole river, killed all the fish, all the salmon, and all the life in the entire river. So the mine that was already there, there is an existing mine there called, in those days it was called Westmid Mine, they had already had a fine for polluting the river and killing the fish. So the whole issue, if we had more mines on that headwater of that watershed, Butter Lake and Campbell River, the Campbell River itself would be in jeopardy, that it could kill all the fish if we had more sulfuric acid and more dissolved copper. So not only were the environmentalists and the park protectors online, all the fishermen and all the people who cared about the fish and the drinking water were supporting this too. So that makes the issue much broader in the population than just those that care about the environment.
So how was the Friends of Strathcona Park organized? I believe you had chapters in different areas?
That's correct. Because we have been visiting, and we is my husband and myself, we have been visiting the various corners of the park. The Strathcona Park is quite large when you look on the map, and it is surrounded by different communities. You have Campbell River to the northeast, Courtney to the east, Port Alberni to the south, a little bit further south, Parksville, and then to the west is Tofino. So there are different towns and different cities, different people. So they all wanted to help. And also people who lived in the biggest cities like Nanaimo, further south, Victoria, and Vancouver. People used to go hiking there, alpine clubs, outdoor clubs, mountaineering clubs. So they all wanted to help. So what we decided to do, create a chapter in each town and delegate the responsibility to them so we had more momentum.
Some conservation groups at the time apparently believed there was no point in fighting the government's decision. What made you feel differently?
The biggest thing for me was, first of all, there had been no fight. So how can you lose a fight when you haven't even entered the ring to fight? So we hadn't even engaged in a fight, so you can't give it up. And two, I had made a commitment to Jim Balding, so at least I should try. Third one, because I was kind of the mouthpiece at that time, was that I came from Holland. I was born post-war. I had two parents that were both involved in the underground resistance. And from them, I learned the David and Goliath perspective. So even though you have a dominant government that is corporate dominated, we are supposed to do what the government tells us to do because we are supposed to have represent. We have voted for them. However, they didn't represent us. And I had to give honors to my parents. They fought in the underground resistance. They never submitted themselves to the Nazis and the Germans in the Second World War. And because of that, I am on this planet. I am alive. What they did, what I was faced with, my little battle was a piece of cake compared to a world war. And also I had been involved in what we would now call activism for gay and lesbian rights in Holland, for the rights of women to be able to vote, for the rights of black people to simply have dark colored skin and still be called humans. So I had that background that at least you had to give it a fight. And I was backed up by a lot of environmental activists that had stood in other battles. For example, Mears Island in Blackwood Sound.
In 1987, the Friends of Strathcona Park set up a civil disobedience committee. Did many of you have experience previously with direct action?
Few people had, but most people had not. In our board, in the groups, once the group grew from 3 or 4 people to enough people, about 300, and it ended up 800 or 1,000, we formed a board of directors. And close by to where we live, close by Courtney, is a little island called Denman Island, which is full of dropout university-trained people. In that group were 3 people that had just set up a mediation service and conflict resolution service. So they really believed in the Gandhi principle, and I believed in that too, for nonviolent resistance. So they came up with the suggestions that if we would do anything like blockading or anything like that, that we would really adhere to the nonviolent method, nonviolent resistance. So everybody supported that. On the heels of that, we all needed to be trained and understand and learn what nonviolent resistance means. So that resulted in a series of workshops where we did role-playing. One group would be the blockaders, the other group would be loggers or miners or the police, and being pretty aggressive. And then we were taught methods how you do de-escalate the aggression and the opposition and what you can do and how you have to think. I think that itself was very, very good thing to do. I really completely supported that. One of the workshops, we invited the RCMP, the police, from Campbell River, which was the nearest town who would have to be coming. They would be the ones who would come to the blockade to arrest. The police was very, very happy to do that. Part of the day, we were the blockaders, they were the police, and then we would return the roles, and then we would talk about it. How did you feel about that? What did you learn of this? Not only did the police really appreciated that, but we became friends and we understood each other. They also agreed with us, so they were not impartial, because they lived down the watershed of Battle Lake, and more mining on Battle Lake would mean more fish would be killed in the Campbell River, which is a main spawning river for the salmon, but also the pollution from the mine would pollute their drinking water. So they were 100% behind us.
Was the inspiration to use direct action at the beginning of 1988 drawn from recent successful blockades, such as those against logging in other parts of British Columbia, like Mears Island and Haida Gwaii?
Yes, and it also came from other activist things, like for the human rights activism in the United States. It was an ideal situation where the mining exploration drill rigs had to come into the park. There was only one access. So there was only one little road, which was about 50 feet, 40 or 50 feet wide. And there was a lake on one side and a mountainside on the other side. Okay. So it's ideal to blockade it. That's what we did. And it wasn't really planned. We didn't have an agreement within the board that we would actually blockade. But one of the people who was a part of the group, and an avid hiker, he just gave us a phone call early, 4 o'clock in the morning. I got a phone call. We have blockaded the road. We need help. And he just went up there with his family, and they just parked their cars across the road, and it was maybe 2 or 3 cars, and they were there, and that's how it started. We had a phone tree, and so the message went out via the phone within 24 hours, and within 24 hours we had 30, 60 people there, and then it took a life on its own. So first of all, as I said earlier on, we had actually active training And the training was done by people who were professionally trained via the Justice Institute in Vancouver. A lot of people got trained, and we always made sure, I was kind of a little bit the coordinator, but other people were coordinating as well, that there would, at every moment, day or night, there would always be 4, 5, or 6 people present that had gone through that training. And they would work together, and anybody that wanted to come onto the blockade were told, these are our rules. No violence, politeness, respect with the police at all time, politeness and respect with the mining company and the workers, polite and respect with everybody. There's no violence. So people that were not willing to be polite and follow the code of ethics and the strict rules and regulations, they were asked to leave. And then when it came to, in the beginning, the wonderful thing was the police were probably the best part of the whole thing. They, when the mining company called them, whenever they wanted to get in there and they went to get an injunction, they called, first of all, they called the police, and the police said, sorry, we are busy. It's about an hour's drive from Campbell River, and they were busy. They couldn't spare anybody, they were busy. So after 3 days, they told them to get an injunction, and then they phoned them again. Now we are 5 days later, and the police said, well, we maybe will have free tomorrow, but right now we have a football game going on and with the kids. We're too busy. We can't. We can't come. Which really, when you think about it, is hilarious. So then they came in civilian clothes, deliberately in civilian clothes because they were like civilians. And they had a chat with us, and they explained what was going to happen and what they would do. And they said, we really don't want to arrest you guys because we agree with you. And you know, it was a cold wintry day with snow and snow flurries, so we kept them warm around our fire and gave them warm and hot chocolate. We were good friends. So finally, when it came to the arrest, the local police didn't really want to come, and they had to get reinforcement from other towns further away, which was absolutely a big boost for us, a big boost and confidence for the nonviolent training that we were doing. We just silently blockade, prevented the drill rigs and their bunkhouse to come in. We just didn't let them in. And then finally, they got an injunction. They went to the courts, and we fought the injunction, but the judge didn't even want to listen to us, so they gave him an injunction. And then on the heels of the injunction, they slapped us. I don't know if you know about that technique. That was a technique that corporations used, and they actually are just starting to use it again now, is an intimidation thing. So they sue people, let's say they sued me and a few other people whose names they knew, and anybody else who would be working under the name of the Friends of Strathcona Park for untold damages that they couldn't work their claims. It was just an intimidation technique, but it was scary enough. We owned a house and we had to put it in somebody else's name so that we had nothing to our name. Yeah, it works a little bit because some people backed off, but the majority didn't back off. So it made us even more determined. So then things changed, by the way, when they had slap-suited us and the police actually arrested people. They made sure they guided, who held everybody off, and they guided everybody, they guided the bunkhouse and the drill rig into the site.
Did the company follow through with their slap suit?
They never did. It is just an intimidation. They never do because it infringes on human rights and they can't prove it. So it never has been, and none of these slap suits have ever been successful in court. So that is why it is just an intimidation that has not worked.
Mist, Mister, teeming gurdy, green brain facing lobotomy, climate control center for the world, ancient cord of coexistence hacked by a parasitic greedhead scam, from Sarawak to Amazonas, Costa Rica to mangy BC hills, Cortez rhythm of falling timber. a currency grows in these new deserts, these brand new floodplains. If the tree falls in the forest, does anybody hear? Does anybody hear? Anybody hear the forest fall? Cotton, move on. Cotton, move on. Take out trees. Take out wildlife at a rate of a species every single day. Take out people who've lived with this for 100,000 years. Inject a billion burgers worth of beef. Grain eaters. Methane dispensers. Thinning ozone, waves fall on wrinkled earth. Gravity, light, ancient refuse of stars speak of a drowning. But this is something other. Busy monster eats dark holes in the spirit world, where wild things have to go to disappear.
You're listening to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a summer series on Community Radio 3CR, which looks at the history of environmental blockading in Australia, Canada and the US. The track we just heard was a live version of Bruce Cockburn's If a Tree Falls, which is probably the best-known Canadian environmental song of the 1980s. I'm Ian McIntyre, and today's program features a conversation with Canadian activist Marlena Smith, where we pick up the conversation blockading was attempting to disrupt mining exploration during January 1988. Unlike in Australia and the US at this time, in British Columbia, the government generally treated blockades in remote areas as a civil issue. This required those being obstructed to apply for and receive a court injunction against activists before police could arrest and remove them.
And then we actually would have actions to, for instance, they had a little fence, snow fence around the drill rig because they are not allowed to use the drill rig when there's people right in front of it. So a group of people would just sing songs from Old Canada most of the time, or We Shall Overcome, and they would make the circle tighter and tighter and tighter, and oops, the snow fence was pushed over, and then people would lay in front of the drill rig. But these things would always happen kind of spontaneously. The company would phone the police, and then I would get a call because I was one, my husband and I were the liaison between the police and the people that would get arrested. So I lived in Parksville at that time. I had to get my butt up there, an hour and a half drive, be there at the time that the police was there and negotiate if these people should be arrested or not arrested, blah, blah, blah. And all that negotiation went beautifully. 30 police to arrest 4 or 5 people. And we always made, when people were at the beginning of the day, we would say, okay, if there's an action, who wants to be arrested today? And if people wanted to be arrested, would they know, they were told what would happen and what their rights were and what they couldn't do? Then they would be asked to have a buddy. I don't know if that system was elsewhere used, but that is what we used. So one person who was there would then make sure that the car would be returned home. If they had kids or family or animals to look after, that person would take care of their home affairs. That person would be there to take them out of the jail and bring them home. So every person had a buddy person. And that was made it less intimidating for people to get arrested. But we also limited the arrest to no more than 6 at the time. So then we wouldn't lose all our bodies. People like myself, I never could get arrested because they couldn't, you know, you would get an order from the courts that you would not be allowed to turn back to the site. They wanted me to be at the site at all times, so I could never get arrested. So I never was arrested. Not every action was pre-planned in the way that the whole organization and the board would be involved. So the people on site had their own authority to do what they wanted to do, as long as there were enough people that had done the non-violent conflict resolution workshops. So they would have every morning at the site, and you have to remember this was in the middle of winter, and it is cold. The rains, sleets, and snow almost every single day, and people were camping in little tents. Some people slept in the cars. Somebody rigged up a little shelter out of tarps, and somebody brought a stove. There was a baker in Courtney that came every other day with fresh baked goods. So the people there had a permanent connection with the local television producer. That was a community-owned television organization. So somebody would be sent to a place where you could make a phone call and then inform him. So in the morning, they would have a little gathering and decide what are we going to do today. And if they decided we're going to do, let's say, a march or a mock march or whatever they decided to do to interrupt the drilling, they would then phone the television producer, who had a friend who was a journalist, and they would both come, or one of them would come at the time, you know, at the right time there, so he could video it. Then he would rush back home again, and he would get a video clip that he rushed to the island. This was before we had internet transmission off. So they would get it to the main television station, who would then have it on the television. So okay. In that respect, it was coordinated. And in the other respect, it would happen spontaneous from day to day. And what action would be planned depended how many people were there, what the people wanted to do, if we could get the media on site or not. So it all worked out really well, because basically for the 3 months or 2.5 months that the blockade was there, it was on the television, on the news, either the BC News or the national news, every single day. for about 30 days. Blockading was almost every day, and then only when the media could be there, then they would plan an arrest. And then we would let the police know too. You know, we're planning an action today, and the police would be ready. And then when the mining company would call, the police would be there, because they had to get guys from other cities. There was not enough police in Campbell River, and the police in Campbell River was not really that interested. And we had other actions as well, like we would have a person, I don't know if you have heard in Australia, of a man called David Suzuki. He was quite a well-known environmental activist, certainly in those days. So we invited him to come and make a presentation. And then we would send that out on our telephone tree. So that day when he would be there, and he came and he gave a little speech, that day there would be 300 people. And those would be the day that most of the time the media was there, and we would have another arrest. Okay, they hired a security company called Pinkertons, and the guys would be there at night, and at night nobody would ever touch anything. We did not do any destructive action, so we would not put sugar in their tanks, or we didn't wreck anything. We would be respectful. We never did any damage. So the security guys had nothing to do. They would have discussions with us, and they would talk to us. And I remember very well, I think that was on the evening before the first arrest, and I walked down away from where everybody was camping, because we were camping away from the equipment. The drill rig was in there at that time, just to kind of get my mind together and meditate a little bit. And the security guy kept following me. And so at one point, I just stopped and I said, "Do you want to talk?" And he said, "Why are you guys doing this? It's in the middle of winter. It's miserable weather. Why don't you just give up?" And I looked at him and I said, "What the government wants to do and what the mining company wants to do is not okay. And all the people that make these decisions are all boys. Well, you call them men, but I call them boys. So I'm your mother and saying to you, this is not okay. And I'm going to stop you. Is that clear?" And he looked at me and he said, "Wow, that hit home." And after that, we had perfect relationship. There was only two of them. And they had, what could they do? They had no guns. They were not allowed to be violent. So what can they do? They were not allowed to arrest us. It was another form of intimidation. And we just decided to ignore them. We had one guy who climbed the drill rig, which we were a little bit concerned about, but that went okay. No, I don't think we ever had anything of chaining people to equipment. That was done more in Clackwood Sound with the logging. I think there was no need for it. The group of 11 people, I think, that decided to get arrested en masse, all 11 of them at one arrest. And they asked for permission from us not to sign the agreement. And we said, "Well, that is up to you." So they didn't sign the agreement, and they were transferred to a minimum security facility in Nanaimo and spent a day or two there, and then they released them anyway.
How many people were usually at the protest camp, and where did they hail from?
It varied. If there was nothing really planned and it was a really nasty day, there could be as little as 10 to 30 people. If the weather was not too bad and we had a big thing planned like David Suzuki, we could have 300 or 400 people there. So on the average, there was always a core group of about 10, 15 people. Oh, there were quite a few people coming from even as far as the Slocan Valley, which is in the middle of, eastern part of British Columbia, Vancouver, Victoria. A lot of people were, I would say, at least 50% were not local. Because don't forget that the battle in Strathcona Park was on basis of the government making changes to all the provincial parks. So everywhere over the whole province, there were groups of friends of a park that was also threatened to have areas deleted for mining and logging. The government didn't pay attention to those parks because Strathcona Park was the first one that was on the block. And being at the first one, everybody realized if we won that battle, we won't win the battle for the rest of the province as well.
What were the connections between First Nations in the campaign?
All of that park is in unceded territory, so they have never signed a treaty and an agreement. So we went to the chiefs of each First Nations, because it's an overlapping area, asked them permission to do the blockade. And they came actually to the blockade site and did a ceremony and gave us their blessing. And they asked us and they thanked us for to stand up on their behalf to protect the park. So that was the reason I bring this up. That came out in court as well, that we did not do this for ourselves. We had an acknowledgement that it was First Nations unceded territory.
Did the blockade feature a firm strategy from its beginning?
My perspective of life has always been being a rock climber and a mountaineer, kayak canoeer, whitewater canoeer. I have always had where I want to go, my goal. I have defined it, researched it, and say that's where we're going to go. It was obvious. It was a park. The government and the people had committed to protect those areas for their natural beauty. And all we were doing is hold the government's feet to the fire. And I had never any question in my mind, never any doubt in my mind that we would achieve that goal. And how it would be achieved, that evolved. Yeah, we didn't have any particular strategy. We just knew, but as long as I kept in mind and kept reminding everybody that somebody had to step up, you know, up to the plate and draw a line in the sand to say, this is how far you go, and you don't go past that. You can't change this, and you're not going to change it. We won't let you change it. So, and that is all the vision that I held.
To what degree were you influenced by the successful Tasmanian campaign to prevent the Franklin Dam in 1983?
That little booklet was given to me from friends from Clackwood Sound because they said, you should know about this. It's written by the blockaders from day to day, and we were already on the blockade, and we were already politically involved. But Bob Brown had a very clear vision about the political end. So I realized we have to be more sophisticated on the political end. And not only did I realize that, I also knew that being a veterinarian and a keen observer of animals, I knew that people act and react and do things within a very limited behavior pattern. So it happened to be that the Franklin blockade happened at the same political time with a right-wing government and a more left-wing government. And the right-wing government, people were already very unhappy about them. And so if they would get the other government to support them, and they would support the government, then when there would be election and they would win, they will not forget that support. So I looked day by day what was happening. And when I saw similarities between what was happening at the Franklin blockade and what was happening here, I would look at, okay, so what is our government doing right now? What would they predictable do at this point? Which was, for example, conflict of interest. So I noticed that there was some conflict of interest there. And so I sent one person in our group and research it and find enough evidence that this particular minister, which happened to be the Minister of Parks, had conflict of interest because he had shares in mining companies, and he had actually shares in a mining company that wanted to explore in the park. So we exposed that to the media, and it totally blew them out of the water because they hadn't expected that. So yeah, that strategy where the Franklin blockade came in was very handy because I could kind of know or predict or think this is what the government is going to do next, and I would tell the media about it before the government would do it. And the government was convinced that we had a person within their chambers that would tip us off, which we didn't. But it certainly had the effect of unnerving them quite seriously.
What other forms of campaigning were going on during the blockade?
We made friends with the people of the opposition party that were going to run for political representatives. And we lobbied them and we talked to them and we invited them to come to the blockade site and hear our issues. And they were on site pretty soon and pretty quickly. So they would then raise these issues in parliament. So it was in parliament almost every day as well. And the media, of course, got wind of that. So they realized, whoa, this must be important. So the other day thing we did as well, we lobbied the local government. We have regional district governments and we have city governments. So that is where it came in handy to have chapters. So in all up and down the whole island, as well as most parts of the mainland in Vancouver, the local governments were lobbied to stand behind us and to ask the provincial government to put a moratorium on drilling in the park. And I think that eventually had an effect too. It's a multifaceted approach. And the good thing was there were people, as I said, a lot of the people that were involved, and that makes a big difference as well. A lot of those people had university education. So we had people that were trained. We had five or six lawyers that acted on our behalf pro bono. And we had several MD, medical doctors. We had more than one vet, teachers. So we had a wide group of people to strategize with.
What happened after exploration stopped and the blockade came to an end?
After the blockade was over, we still didn't quite trust it. And we set up a summer camp to, one, inform every visitor that came by there so they would be informed what was going on. And also to keep an eye on it that nobody would be out there to do exploration drilling. But it was not a blockade. It was more a camp that was always one or two people were there. And we called it, for the parks, we called it a visitors information center. But it was really to keep an eye on that nobody would sneak in there.
By the time exploration had been completed at Strathcona Park in late March 1988, the provincial government had applied a moratorium on further exploration and had begun negotiating with campaigners. Prior to elections in 1990, the provincial government endorsed a report calling for a new ban on mining and logging in the park. However, it was only with the election of the New Democratic Party in 1990 that the park's boundaries were upgraded. After this, the mining industry accepted that the issue was too controversial and withdrew from exploration in other parks. What are your memories of how the campaign wrapped up and how the park was protected?
First of all, there was a change of government on hand. So towards the end of the blockade, it was very close to elections. And because the whole environmental movement supported the NDP did get in. And that is how, at that time, they brought the park back again to a Class A park and put a moratorium on mining exploration in all the Class A parks. Now, one of our board members had a friend in Vancouver who was a lawyer, actually a really good corporate lawyer. And he looked at the court case and the government's reason to open up the park. And he said, wait a minute. When Cleve Silver took the government to court, the courts then said, no, you don't need government. You don't need to compensate Cleve Silver because it's a free miner claim and they don't own the land. So even though Cleve Silver had sued the government, the courts, first the lower courts and then the Supreme Court from Canada, both of them said, no, you don't need to compensate them. So the lawyer who found that said, hey, the government doesn't need to do that. Take it to court and see what the court says. Twice they have been turned down. This is not a reason to open the parks up for mining. So we presented that opinion to the government, who initially ignored it, but then when the fire under their feet got a bit too hot, decided to have a second look at that. And then when we changed government, so we got now an NDP government, the person that was appointed as Attorney General happened to be the local MLA of Campbell River, who was very sympathetic to our cause. So when Cleve Silver, after the park was closed for mining again, it's not that he didn't find anything. The government just decided, no, you're not going to explore for mining. They then sued the government again. And then the Attorney General used our legal opinion and our perspective to challenge Cleve Silver. And so twice it has now been to the provincial court and to the High Supreme Court of Canada. And both of them have said, no government, you don't need to compensate. Where we are right now, we believe that the government has taken a lot of these mining claims back that were free miner claims. They have compensated them as they should for the value of the land, not for the value of untold minerals, because they don't own the mining claims. It is a complicated thing, but right now we think the park is pretty well free of mining claims. The assistant deputy minister of the environment and parks, that is one department in Canada, in BC, said when I had a discussion with him once, and he said, don't you think that you didn't have an effect on the government? As soon as they hear the word Friends of Strathcona Park, everybody runs to their offices and closes the door. They don't want to have anything to do with it. So I think it was a really wake-up call for the local government that just because you're in government doesn't mean you can ignore the wishes and desire of the people. We still have an obligation to listen to the people.
What happened with the court cases that those arrested during the blockade faced?
The charges were all for mischief, which is within the criminal code. I said earlier on, we had about 5 lawyers. They advised us for everything that we needed. They did all the legal research for us. And we had one lawyer who was very young at that time, who was kind of the top criminal lawyer in BC. And he came to do a free workshop, what to do when you would go to court. So to explain the criminal law, to explain what the crown prosecutor would do, how you can respond, what is the best way to respond, how to hold your horses, where to go. And that there were 64 people that had to go to court because there were 64 people were arrested. Some of them had one of the lawyers, 5 lawyers to represent them, but half of them wanted to do their own defense. But he did an absolutely superb workshop on the criminal code as it applies to blockading a mischief. This is a funny one. You may not have heard this one. But the judge that was who was assigned in Campbell River, because it was within the district of Campbell River, was as a young man, he was the president of the Campbell River Water Board, who was in the 50s and the 60s. And there was only one, the government wanted to give a permission to what is called then, was then called Westman Mine, to open the mine up at the headwaters of Butter Lake. And he made an agreement, the government, Kiernan, that was the Minister of Mines and Parks at that time. He was Minister of Mines before, but then he became Minister of Parks. He made an agreement with the Campbell River Water Board that that would be the only mine ever allowed on that watershed, and it would be just a little drill hole in the ground. The person he made the agreement with was our judge. So within a week after that agreement was signed, that same minister, Kiernan, gave permission to Cream Silver to stake claims on that same watershed. So you can't say that this judge was impartial. He was then taken off the bench once the government realized, and we got another judge, but he still had the influence. Court case was still about people breaking the injunction, and the court still had given the injunction to the mining company. So really, technically speaking, legally speaking, all the defense that we had, we didn't have a leg to stand on. However, the judge, the first judge, if a government changes the zoning in the park, they made it from a Class A park, they downgraded it to a Class B park to allow the mining and logging. When you do that here in BC, because it is an act of legislation to do that, or to change that zoning or that designation, the public has to know about this. So we have to either get it in all the local newspaper and give or whatever. The public has to know long enough about it. And what they have to do, they have to publish it in a paper called the Gazette, the government newspaper that all the other newspapers get their information from. And the judge found that the government failed to do so. So the whole act of downgrading it and giving the permit to Cream Silver in the first place was an illegal act. Subsequently, the whole injunction was illegal. So that was the technicality. We didn't find it, but our dear friend, the judge, did find it. Karma never really crossed somebody to that degree because it will always come back on you.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
I talked about my own contribution, but this would have never happened, you know, without all the people that actually stepped up to the plate. You know, without Carl Stevenson and his family being there and starting the blockade. Without the people that convinced us and organized the conflict resolution and nonviolent action workshops and are still doing that for other groups that are busy on blockading or whatever. And with all the hundreds and other people, there's so many people have, you know, it was really a momentum that I guess the time was right for it, and hundreds of people contributed to it. And I played a very minor role, but, you know, it happened to be that I was the one that started it. You know, hundreds of people that made this happen, and I'm eternally grateful for them. And I'm still on guard for Strathcona Park. You know, I'm not doing anything, not much these days, but if it comes, if the parks would be under threat again, I will do it all over again.
You've been listening to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a summer series on Community Radio 3CR, which looks at the history of environmental blockading in Australia, Canada and the US. I'm Ian McIntyre, and today's program featured a conversation with Canadian activist Marlena Smith about the campaign against mineral exploration in Strathcona Park from 1986 onwards. I hope you can tune in again next week between 11 a.m. and noon on Saturday for the last instalment of the series. Today I'll leave you with a song by Willie Mitchell and the Desert Fire Band called Killin' Your Mind. This is drawn from a compilation album released in 2014 entitled Native North America Volume 1. This collected rare and out-of-print recordings from the 1960s and 1970s by First Nations, Métis and Inuit musicians from Canada and Alaska.
Sitting round the fire, burning grass and chanting to himself. The only sound you heard was someone talking, and the sound of the fire making love. Deep inside their soul, the spirit's listening, keeping them in line with nature's own. Up above, the silver bow is gleaming, giving light to guide us through the night. Ah, but now we have an ugly spirit, no, and he walks around in a good disguise. And he comes in the color of our people. You can always see it in their eyes. Killing the kind, always wonder if they do mind. Killing the mind, killing the kind, always wonder if they do mind. When they're confused. I've seen the chief playing for the warriors, for all the ones who have died for the cause. The precious smoke is blown in four directions. Red gold throws tobacco on the fire. I had a vision that just don't have a meaning. Maybe I'm just blinded by today. I've seen some people laughing at the other, just because they were living their native way. That's why I say now we have an ugly spirit, and he walks around in a good disguise. He also comes in the color of our people. Oh yes he does. You can always see it in their eyes. Killing their man, killing their kind. Always wonder if they do mind. Killing their mind, killing the kind. Always wonder if they do mind. Killing the mind, killing the kind. Always wonder if they do mind. Killing the mind, killing the kind. Always wonder if they do mind.